listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Ian McEwan's new novel, Solar, has been called the first great novel about global warming. Follow Michael Beard, an overweight Nobel Prize-winning physicist whose best work, the Einstein-Beard conflation, is long behind him, on a trip to the Norwegian Arctic with a boat full of self-important artists and scientists. They're going north to see global warming in action. Michael is almost eaten by a polar bear. He keeps losing his boots and gloves. His goggles are cracked and clouded with marmalade, and he nearly freezes off his pecker. In short, the journey is hilarious, but even better, noted one reviewer, quote, is the way McEwan deftly contrasts the high ideals of the travelers who call for a new, greener way of life with their unacknowledged selfishness. Ian McEwan was born in 1948, I took a year off his life, in Aldershot, Hampshire, England. He spent much of his childhood in the Far East, Germany, and North Africa, where his father, an officer in the army, was posted. His works have earned him worldwide critical acclaim. He won the Somerset Maugham Award in 1976 for his first collection of short stories, First Love, Last Rites, the Whitbread Novel Award, and the Prix Femina Etranger for The Child in Time, the Man Booker Prize in Fiction for Amsterdam in 1998, and his novel Atonement received the National Book Critics Circle Fiction Award and the Los Angeles Times Prize for Fiction, among others. He's also the author of the prize-winning novels Saturday and On Chesil Beach. He is a fellow of both the Royal Society of Literature and the Royal Society of Arts, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Science, and in 2000, he was awarded the CBE. And that's Commander of the British Empire, in case you didn't know there still was a British Empire. We are deeply honored to present Ian McEwan on the Aloud series for the first time. And joining him after he reads, as I said, will be literary critic David Kippen. David is the author of The Schreiber Theory, a radical rewrite of American film history, and translator of Cervantes' The Dialogue of the Dogs. Until January 2010, he was a literature director for the National Endowment of the Arts, where he directed the Big Read and the Guadalajara Book Festival initiatives. And he also served from 98 to 2005 as book critic, and before that, book editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. And you can look for his first LA Times op-ed as a new LA resident in tomorrow's paper. Again, make sure your cell phones and pagers are turned off, and please join me in welcoming Ian McEwan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be back in LA after quite a long period of absence. I used to come here regularly on film business, on movie business, and it's actually a much more honest process to be here on book business, less upsetting. Before I begin my conversation with David, we thought we'd just give you, this is not really going to be a reading as such, it's just a taster. But Michael Beard, not the nicest of men, something of a scoundrel, has been a deep climate change skeptic. And now he's a recent convert to the cause. He has in his possession important forms of scientific and technological breakthroughs to do with artificial photosynthesis. In other words, a way of imitating the manner in which a leaf can, in part of its process of using the sun's energy, break water into the gases of hydrogen and oxygen. You don't need to, you know, if you're technophobia, don't worry, you don't have to keep that in mind. But some people like to know these things. So here he is now about to address a meeting in the Savoy Hotel, London, where he will be addressing a gathering of pension fund managers and city types, and he hopes that some of their money will slip into the direction of his own company. But he's late. He was running out of time. Everyone was, it was the general condition. But Michael Beard, bloated by an unwanted lunch, shifting under his seatbelt, could think only of his diminishing hours of the day and of what he stood to lose. It was 2:30, and his plane, already 1 hour late, still lumbered oafishly clockwise in a stack above South London. Too troubled to continue reading, gnawing ineffectually from time to time and from an awkward angle on a tender spike of cuticle in the corner of his thumbnail, a Whitlow in the making, he watched his familiar corner of England rotate below him. What else could he do? This was not the time for lofty retrospection or overviews, just when he should have been rushing down streets, along corridors. But much of his past and many of his preoccupations were down there, 3,000 metres below the expensive seat that others, as usual, had paid for. Here was a commonplace sight that would have astounded Newton or Dickens. He was gazing east, through a great rim of ginger grime. It could have been detached from an unwashed bathtub and suspended in the air. He was looking past the city, down the bulging, widening Thames, past oil and gas storage tanks towards the brown flatlands of Kent and Essex, and the scene of his childhood, and the outsized hospital where his mother had died, not long after she told him of her secret life. And beyond, the open jaw of the tidal estuary and the North Sea, an unwrinkled nursery blue in the February sunshine. Then his gaze was rotated southward through a silvery haze over the Weald of Sussex towards the soft line of the South Downs, whose gentle folds once cradled his raucous first marriage, a synesthesia of misguided love, infant excrement and wailing of their lodgers' twins, and the heady quantum calculations that led 15 years and 2 divorces later to his Nobel Prize. His prize, which had half blessed, half ruined his life. Beyond those hills was the English Channel, trimmed with frills of pinkish cloud that obscured the coast of France. Now, a fresh tilt of the aircraft wings turned him into the sunlight and a view of West London, and just below the trembling engines slung beneath the wing, his improbable destination, the microscopic airport, and around it the arterial feeds and traffic pulsing down them like corpuscles, M4, M25, M40, the charmless designations of a hard-headed age. Benignly, the glare from the west softened a little the industrial squalor. He saw the Thames Valley, a pallid winter green looping between the Berkshire Downs and the Chiltern Hills. Beyond, lost to view, was Oxford and the laboratory toiling of his undergraduate years and the finely calculated courting of his first wife, Maisie. And now, here it came again. For the sixth time, the colossal disk of London itself turning like an intricately slotted space station in majestic self-sufficiency. As unplanned as a giant termite nest, as a rainforest, and a thing of beauty, gathering itself to great human intensity at the centre along the rediscovered river between Westminster and Tower Bridge, dense with confident, playful architecture, new toys. Briefly, he thought he saw the plane's shadow flitting like a free spirit across St. James and over the rooftops, but this was impossible at such a height. He knew about light. Among those millions of roofs, 4 had sheltered his 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th marriages, and these alliances had defined his life, and they were all, no point denying it, calamities. These days, whenever he came in over a big city, he felt the same unease and fascination. The giant concrete wounds dressed with steel, the catheters of ceaseless traffic filing to and from the horizon, the remains of the natural world could only shrink before them. The pressure of numbers, the abundance of inventions, the blind forces of desires and needs looked unstoppable and were generating a heat, a modern kind of heat that had become, by clever shifts, his subject, his profession, the hot breath of civilization. He felt it. Everyone was feeling it, on the neck, in the face. Beard, gazing down from his wondrous and wondrously dirty machine, believed in his better moments that he had the answer to the problem. At last he had a mission, It was consuming him, and he was running out of time. Even as his Essex childhood swung back into view, he was so late. He could trace the route he should have been making among the miniaturized streets as neatly etched by winter sun as a printed circuit. He thought he could see the very building in the Strand he was supposed to be in now. Then it was gone. And there were two other roofs tipping away from him unseen to the northwest. One sheltered his icy, neglected, chaotic Marylebone apartment. His mind's eye permitted him to see in a darkened room the half-eaten meal he had abandoned 3 months ago with a half-forgotten friend for some night errand. He had not been back and had not seen her since. The place was a midden. In the bedroom next door, in the unheated air, he saw the sensual disorder of the bed, the pillows on the floor, the orange standby lights of the hi-fi still glowing, and, scattered about the place, the books and journals he was reading at the time. He struggled to remember them, and that day's newspapers, and a champagne bottle, and in two glasses the evaporated tide mark of the inch or two they had failed in their hurry to finish. Over these, over the plates in the dining room, the pans in the kitchen, on the garbage in the pail and spread across the chopping board, and even on the coffee grounds in the dried-out filter paper, there would be vigorous, differently hued fungal growths in creamy whites and soft greyish greens, a blossoming on the abandoned cheese, the carrots, the hardened gravy, airborne spores. A parallel civilization, invisible and mute, successful living entities. Yes, they would have long settled to their specialized feasts. And when the fuel ran out, they would dry to a smear of charcoal dust. The other roof sheltered Melissa Brown, his somewhat neglected love, and it was under this second that he intended to spend the night. She was so kind to him, so soft, so patient, so pretty, the only viable love in his life. Like many women, she thought he was a brilliant scientist, a genius in need of rescuing. But he was such a careless, faithless, disorganized friend, too elusive, too stonily intent on never marrying again. He hadn't phoned. She was cooking dinner. He didn't deserve her. Guilt and a fresh surge of impatience, a vile brew, made him groan. Did he actually make a sound above the engine's note? And here were the South Downs again to remind him that he must never yield. He must never change his mind. His aging frame could not withstand a sixth marriage. Whichever direction his gaze fell, this was home, his native corner of the planet. The fields and hedgerows once tended by medieval peasants and 18th century labourers still visibly patterned the land in irregular quadrilaterals. And every brook, fence and pigsty, virtually every tree was known and probably named in the Doomsday Book after all-conquering William in 1085 conferred with his advisers and sent his men all over England. And ever since, named again with greater refinement, owned, used, costed, traded, mortgaged, mature like a thick-crusted Stilton, as richly stuffed with varied humanity as Babel, as historical as the Nile Delta, teeming like a charnel house with ghosts, in public discourse as dissonant as a rookery in full throat. One day, this brash and ancient kingdom might yield to the force of multiple cravings, to the dreamy temptations of a giant metropolis, a Mexico City, Sao Paulo and Los Angeles combined, to effloresce from London to the Medway, to Southampton, to Oxford, back to London, a modern form of quadrilateral, burying all previous hedges and trees. And who knew, perhaps it would be a triumph of racial harmony and brilliant buildings, a world city, the most admired world city in the world. How, wondered Beard, has his plane at last quit the stack on a banking hairpin tangent and lined itself up north of the Thames to begin its descent? How could we ever begin to restrain ourselves? We appeared at this height like a spreading lichen, a ravaging bloom of algae, a mould enveloping a soft fruit. We were such a wild success, up there with the spores. Thank you.
You got a line wrong, you know.
I change things.
Still?
How can I get it wrong?
What's that?
How can I get it wrong?
So how did his frame, which couldn't withstand a sixth marriage, become his aging frame?
I thought it needed it. So you thought it needed a trochee. Aging.
So you're going to go back before the paperback? And
possibly, because I've read that more than once. And each time I put in aging.
So should we go back through all your books and compare the hardcovers to the paperbacks? And
there is a PhD, even by a French academic, comparing hardback, paperback, and crucially, British and American versions.
Really?
Yeah.
Is this book different between its British and
American? No, it was because of this PhD. I was so horrified.
It's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. He's observed you and he's changed you in the process.
This is what happens is that you have a very long, honorable tradition of very hard line editors who distribute commas, especially with a sort of abandon. and what happens is that sometime in the 80s, I would receive a large typescript completely covered in pencil lines and marks and amended copy and a lot of commas. And going around each one with a circle and a line and writing stet so bored me that I thought, well, the British edition would be fine and let them have the commas. But I didn't tell anyone. And the American editor, I sent her a few pages of this PhD, and she was horrified. So I said, well, we've got to find another way of working. So now we work with one editor.
British or American?
British. Uh-huh. And then there's an American editor who simply will, if there are obscure lines, obscure words, will, you know, things that don't quite make it across the divide, will make the changes. And that way we've now, so there are small differences, usually of nouns, sidewalk, pavement, or whatever. But otherwise, you know, it's fairly safe. But one of the pleasures of reading, actually, is you know, breathing the words, and I do it while I'm writing.
Mm-hmm. You read aloud as you go?
Read aloud as you go, every paragraph. And sometimes I've discovered, reading that passage, it needs the aging. So I will put it in when it comes to paperback time.
Well, congratulations. It's a terrific book, and I especially went back listening the line about the orange standby lights of the hi-fi still glowing. Please don't change that one for the paperback because it's so perfect. He's left his hi-fi on for 3 months, so you know, is it any wonder he needs to fix global warming?
Exactly. All those standby lights that we could save 6 coal power stations with, I don't know.
The title is sort of audacious in that way because he thinks he's the center of the solar system himself, Michael Beard. And I got to wondering how a character like that germinated for you.
Well, I went to the little town outside Berlin of Potsdam. Potsdam.
Don't say it again, whatever you do.
I just wanted to know. And I was invited by John Schellnuber, who is the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, special scientific advisor, and runs a climate change institute there. And he had the gimmicky notion of inviting only Nobel Prize winners to give the address. So there were 30 of them, mathematicians, physicists, all men. And I was invited to give an after-dinner speech at one point. So I was like a sort of chocolate. I was the mint that comes with the coffee. And literally so, because these were real bull scientists. These were alpha males, men of unbelievable sort of egos and power, and they ran institutes and colossal university departments, and they brought down vast sums of money for satellites. But their Nobel Prize rested on something they did as young men. I mean, especially the mathematicians peak like soccer stars in their mid-20s. And I thought then, If I can manage to write a novel about climate change, I hereby award my character a Nobel Prize. Because I wanted it. Then I thought, how interesting that you should live in the shadow of your own achievement, becoming grander and more important by the day, but doing no science. There was something both chilling and sort of amusing about that. So that's where he came from.
Scientist careers are interesting in that way. I mean, they're sort of the opposite of, I mean, if you're lucky as a musician, you get better and better and better, whereas scientists do tend to peak early. Which of those two extremes do you think writing fiction comes the closer to?
It's a very interesting question because some writers never quite get beyond the blaze of their arrival, and others make interesting, steady movements and progress and changes all along the way. So I think it's pretty hard to characterize. I mean, you look at the career of someone like Saul Bellow. I mean, I think that late Bellow is fantastically interesting and desirable, and I think the same is true of Updike. So I think I find that very hard to define, to say what how that's characterized.
Is there anything you've done or set out to do over your career that's kept it so alive, that's kept you from sort of ossifying into your earlier phase?
Well, I suppose the thing I do is hesitate. I mean, I think hesitation is one of the undersung important moves of any writer.
Between books?
Between books, but it also even between sentences. I mean, in other words, any idea, if you have a good idea on Monday, then you must wait another two or three Mondays to see if it's still a good idea. Because ideas can look good one day and not the next, and they've got to look good over a period of time. And that brings me to the sense that each book has to be your first. It's got to feel like your first. And you've got to learn how to write it all over again. Now, that's why I think writing novels never appears to get easier. I could see why sort of Anthony Pohl, or for that matter Proust, would write a long chain of novels. I could see that it might get a little easier to get from one to the next. But for me, it's been important to make each day the sort of each novel seem like my very first.
You mentioned, speaking of writers' careers, the Nobel Prize. Were you at all superstitious about making it such a continuing motif in this particular book?
No, I have no superstitions. I watched, you can go on YouTube and watch Doris Lessing being told by an American camera crew on the streets of London just outside her house that she'd won the Nobel Prize. It was mid-afternoon. She was getting out of a London cab. There was her son with his arm in plaster, holding an onion, I think, in one hand. And she had three or four shopping bags. She was getting out, and she was in an incredibly bad mood. And this voice that she clearly detested straight away said, I have to tell you, you've won the Nobel Prize. And she said, oh, bloody hell. Like, it was the last thing she needed that afternoon. There's so much going on with the carrots, the onion, trying to get out of the cab. And I thought it was one of the best responses I've ever seen. Completely without gratitude or honor. She was just extremely annoyed.
So you're going to try and avoid grocery shopping on the first Tuesday in October?
No, I think I'm not going to be in this field. Well, John Updike never got the Nobel Prize, which I think was a great shame. But he did send one of his characters on stage right at the end of Beck. And it's a marvelous moment because it's the end of the trilogy. Mm-hmm. So there's a valedictory feel. And he goes on stage to make his acceptance speech and carries with him his one-year-old granddaughter. And she does this thing, is a wonderful last line. He says she makes the clasping and unclasping motion of her right hand that signified goodbye. And that's the end of the trilogy. And it is a marvelous, touching moment.
Talking of Michael Beard, he is a difficult man. How determined were you to make his personality explicable, and more generally with your less reputable characters? You know, how much backstory do you want to give? How do you avoid over-explanation?
I let the reader sit with Michael Beard almost the whole novel and then tell the story right at the end of his childhood and how he met his first wife and wooed her by pretending to know all about John Milton. And it seemed to me that it's more interesting to read of someone's early life if you already know the character, rather than bore everybody with, you know how biographies often begin with pages about the subject's grandparents.
All that David Copperfield kind of crap.
Yeah. And you feel you ought to skip the first 100 pages to get, and beyond the birth and the childhood, you know, get to when he was at least active in the world. He's a scoundrel, Michael Beard. I have loaded him with a lot of human faults. He's to some extent a comic victim. He stands in the long, broad shadow, I think, for any writer in English who attempts this kind of character, scoundrelous, of Falstaff. Hmm. I mean, Falstaff has taken up this space of a man that if you really had to spend time in his company, you'd probably find him odious. But somehow we forgive him. Why? Because, I don't know, he's got life and energy on his side. And my hope for the reader, but of course one can't really control these things, is that by the end of the novel, they see him in all his faults, but they want him somehow to succeed, somehow come through this. And, I won't give the plot away.
Since you mentioned long shadows of previous writers, there's a question I meant to get around to, but maybe I'll jump in with it now. I just, last week, shamefully, got around to reading Saturday, which I loved. And if, for those of you who don't know, it takes place all over the course of a single day. Yeah. And I took particular interest in it because there's talk locally of doing, definitely next June, there's going to be a James Joyce festival in town. And I wondered, I got to thinking about single day novels. I got to thinking about what it must have been like to write Saturday in the wake not only of Ulysses, but of Mrs. Dalloway, and here in Los Angeles, even A Single Man by Christopher Isherwood.
Yeah.
Did you feel yourself sort of partaking of that tradition, and how did you
It's ground well trodden, but it's only a framework. In other words, it's a bit like what it's like to write a sonnet, given that Shakespeare and Walter Raleigh and many others have written them too. Into it, you can pour a whole lifetime. And all those books that take place within a framework of a day have the added possibility of the dimension of time behind. Mm. There is always the past. You think it's actually in a day, but it's not. The trick, the smoke and mirror trick, is you have everything antecedent to this novel. So it's not quite as constricting as you think. You know, it's a bit. I once set a novel in Venice. Now, Venice.
Which one? Sorry.
Comfort of Strangers.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Although I never mentioned Venice in the novel because I wanted to take some liberties with it, but it was clearly Venice.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of spatial equivalent of the temporal novel that's been well trodden, because there's never been a city so visited in literature. Hmm. From Mary McCarthy and Dickens and Thomas Mann and Ruskin. I mean, it's endless. It makes it richer in a way. I mean, your reader does not have to know these other writers, and yet some readers clearly will. You occupy a space that becomes connected, socially connected, aesthetically connected.
In a way, a book like Saturday is of a piece with your other books, because so many of them, and you know, it's no great thunderbolt to make this observation, seem to pivot around a particular scene. They lead up to it. Then the complications ensue thereafter. Mm. You must have asked yourself, or perhaps you've gone out of your way to avoid asking yourself. It's certainly true of this book. How what it might be that draws you to those very pivotal scenes that seem to disrupt everything before and affect everything afterward.
I think they grow out of the privileges and opportunities that prose fiction offers. So the great thing about the novel is you can describe a scene, but you can stop the scene at any moment to reflect on it. And that's always been its methods, I mean, from the 18th century onwards. And that therefore means that if you have a scene of some excitement or crisis, or you've changed the pulse of the prose and you've started to move things towards a set piece, you can unwrap it even as you describe it. In other words, you can slow it all down in ways that, I mean, I know we have slow motion and flashback in movies, but it doesn't have that analytical quality whereby you can go into someone's mind and chart the shifts of emotion, the reasoning or the unreasoning that follows a moment that becomes impacted like that. So it's really making use of what the novel cumulatively has offered us.
One might think that being so adept at the construction, not just of books, but of individual scenes, maybe it's not surprising that you've tried your hand at screenwriting and been fairly successful at it, both in, I suppose, the best known of your movies in the States is The Good Son, and sadly not so well known are The Plowman's Lunch and Sour Sweet, and I think one or two others. Does it come naturally because your form seems, the radical presentation of your work seems to be the scene?
I think of screenplays as being like novellas. I mean, they're about 20,000 words. I mean, yeah. I don't know how it still is with screenplays, but the conceit used to be to show yourself to be a real professional, you have to end on page 108. That was really cool to do that. And I liked
it. Do you fiddle with the font in order to...
No, cheating. No cheating. So that's about 20,000 words, which is a novella. And it has all the demands of a novella. It's interesting, I was sent once by MGM, I've still got it somewhere, a photocopy of a piece of writing by Graham Greene. When Greene came and worked here, he said, I'm not going to write you screenplays, I'll write you novellas. Yeah. And you get some other schmuck to turn them into screenplays. And that's what he did. So this was the 10th man, and MGM at one point interested in my being the schmuck.
Yeah.
And I was very interested. But then it turned out someone had made a verbal promise to someone else. And then in Californian law, a verbal promise had to be tested in the courts as to whether it constituted a contract. And it was decided it did. And so it went off in a direction, became an HBO. That was quite well done, I think. But I was interested that Greene had seen this in this way.
Yeah.
There's not a great gap. And a screenplay, if you think of it in novella terms, has all those demands of economy, maybe a plot and a subplot, but maybe not much more. The precision and necessity of setting up characters quickly and pushing things. Two or three acts seem to be natural to it rather than five, as it were. So, yeah, they're not seen so much as novellas.
You've had very good luck and sometimes not so good having other people adapt your own work. Would you ever adapt your own, or that seems like doing the same thing twice?
Well, I won't embarrass you, but one of my movies you won't have heard of was The Innocent.
Oh, not only have I heard of it, I've dog-eared it to pieces, but I...
But the movie.
Yeah.
With Anthony Hopkins and Campbell Scott and Isabella Rossellini. And I did the screenplay, and it worked out terribly.
Why do you think that was?
I think that John Schlesinger was not particularly well and kept getting quite cross on the set. We were working with an all-German crew, and it didn't help when he called them Nazis. And things got dodgy. So I vowed then never, because I did so many drafts of that, and I thought, if I have to type the names of these characters again, I'm going to kill myself.
Macros, man.
Yeah, but this was 1990. Oh. Come on. Actually, I could have had macros then, I suppose. But now I'm doing On Chesil Beach.
Oh, your own?
Yeah, I decided that since it was short and didn't have any dialogue, and I didn't really want someone else inventing the dialogue of these characters, that I would do it myself. I'm doing it with Sam Mendes, and we're I'm about two-thirds of the way through and enjoying that. And I know it's given me a taste for this. I've been in a sort of prolonged sulk about screenplays. I did two in the mid-90s, one for Gina Davis.
Adaptation or original?
No, it was original, but it was a sequel of The Fly.
Oh.
Now, I know there has been a lesser sequel of The Fly, but this was going to be with her, and I think it was my best screenplay.
Well, that must be very unsatisfying. I mean, you publish a book and, you know, you fill a hall, and then you write a screenplay and work, I assume, almost as hard on it, and nobody gets to see it.
Well, you remember at the end of The Fly, Jeff Goldblum is dead.
Yeah.
Well, at the beginning of my screenplay, Gina Davis is pregnant.
Yeah.
With the genes, the faulty genes of Jeff Goldblum. I mean, of his character. Mm-hmm. Let me make that that important distinction. And gives birth to twins, and she has all the mother's natural anxiety that they're going to be deformed in some way. But they're not. They're perfectly healthy children. But as they grow towards teenagerdom, they start to have very short attention spans and spend all their time on the computer.
Freaks of nature.
And not read books and always getting into mischief and physically overactive. And I had a lot of fun playing with this idea of, were American teenagers flies? And slowly, one of them, you know, starts to have grow a little compound eye, and it's interesting. I mean, I take great interest in genetics. That when I was writing this in the mid 90s, the human genome was thought to consist of 125,000 genes, and all the knowledge I could get about a human genome was by analogy was with Drosophila, with fruit flies, which we know colossally studied. And I had a book, it was my template for this script, it was called How to Make a Fly. And there are many analogous genes between, I mean, we share an awful lot of genes with a fruit fly, it's quite disturbing. It's not that hard to make a fly out of a person. There is a gene, for example, that the fruit fly has, that we have, and it's called, I mean, its function is called How to Make an Eye. So if you take this gene out of a fruit fly and put it on a mouse's knee, you'll grow a mouse's eye, even though the gene has come from a fruit fly. You're looking baffled. No? We have this gene. We share a common ancestor with the fruit fly 700 million years ago.
Yeah.
So think how successful this one little chain of information, how to make an eye, has spread itself out through the living world. It didn't work out with Gina Davis. Oh. Because she wanted to make a pirate movie, and
well, you should pull a Harold Pinter and publish it anyway.
I don't own the rights.
Oh,
this is Hollywood. You don't own the. I'm just the writer.
We'll all have to be French PhDs if we want to read it, I guess. Well, I'm glad you brought up science again because you know, Michael Beard is of course a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and Henry Perowne in Saturday is a surgeon, and you seem unusually among writers to take an interest in the other half of the brain. I mean, I guess famously C.P. Snow wrote The Two Cultures. Do you think that the liberal arts, the humanities and the sciences are farther apart or closer together than they were when he wrote that in, 1960? And is that a good thing or not so good?
I don't know. I think science has forced its way into our consideration, our public policy and so on. But I think the division still exists. And as I get older, I can't help feeling that the whole edifice of the liberal humanities is built on a monstrous fraud. I taught a few days at Caltech a few years ago. Incredibly bright students, some of the brightest kids I've ever met.
Taught what?
Hmm?
Taught what?
Well, I'll get to that.
Okay.
Not much, it seemed. It's not much they didn't know. But what impressed me was that these kids doing maths or physics degrees, just in their spare time to keep themselves amused, were taking literature degrees
really?
As well. And I felt a sort of blush of shame when I think that And I, like everyone, I bet a lot of people here, if they've got a degree at a college, probably got out of bed at midday every day, occasional panic about a term paper, attended a few lectures. And if you're halfway intelligent, you can come away with a good degree. Now, it's very hard in the sciences, and you try it. I mean, they have to be up at 8:30 in the morning, 5 lectures a day. This is how it works in Britain. I'm sure it's the same here. They have to get their minds around some of the most difficult things. And that's why I have this little aside about science. Because many of the scientists I've met have read all the novels I've read, have been to the opera, know the partitas of Bach. They know our stuff, but we don't know their stuff. And I do feel a little flush of intellectual embarrassment about this. And maybe we need to be a little tougher. It's fine for me to say this now. I'm not going back to college. But maybe we need to be a little more demanding. And that all humanities degrees should contain a little embrace of the difficulty of just getting your mind around something relatively simple like the calculus, which actually is really quite tough. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing invention. Think, a guy in a wig in the 18th century thought this up, of how you could describe the changing state of something. Amazing. But I don't think we ever have to confront anything very difficult. Mm. I mean, what's the most difficult thing in literature? Maybe Shakespeare's sonnets. But, it's not as difficult as getting your mind around general theory of Einstein. So, I just think that perhaps the invention of the Cambridge Tripos or whatever it is that set the whole thing going has, to go to university for 3 years and read novels. I'm sure in the early 19th century, people would have thought, that's a ludicrous waste of time and energy. When you could be reading novels and, you should be reading them anyway. Mm.
Well, I mean, I don't want to be skeptical over much, but it could just be that the students at Caltech who take a class from Ian McEwan when he's visiting are the ones who know all the books. But it sounds like you know some very well-rounded scientists. So all the hand-wringing that we hear around us about how, novels are becoming sort of a rarefied occasional taste. You don't feel that?
That hand-wringing's gone on all my life, and the novel has refused to lie down. I still think it offers things that drama, cinema, TV cannot give us. Largely the small print of consciousness. Mm. To get into the cracks of the present, of the inside nature of someone. We're gossipy monkeys, really. We live in, big troops. We're fascinated by each other. And I think literature is a higher form of gossip. Mm. It allows us to talk about each other. We've got well-established mental faculties for recognizing faces, remembering favors, and we have a deep curiosity about each other, and we want to know what it's like to be someone else. Yeah. That's the basis, I think, of ethical systems. And the novels do that in a way. We've developed this tool, and we don't have it in movies. You can't have the inside of someone's thoughts in quite the same way.
You have schooled yourself, it certainly seems, in some of your work, in the way science approaches those very questions, how psychology and neurology have tried to explain consciousness. Has that informed your work, do you think? Not just the work about scientists, but the way you shape a character.
I have got something from it, but I think this is still quite an ancient matter, that science has given maybe some explanations or descriptions, but we don't actually need those to be writing a novel or reading a novel. So I'm wary of what someone has called scientism, where you think that only science is the way forward. There are many ways of describing someone's motives or emotions or inner life. And some of the scientific ways of doing it are sort of interesting, but also stultifying. It doesn't roll forward because you often have a sample of 50 people. And there's no interest in that. The novel is interested in the sample of one. Novels are parochial, they're regional. They generate their universal meanings out of the particular. Science doesn't do that.
Well, science in this book is preoccupied with global warming, and as Louise said, I think rightly, unless you can think of a precedent, maybe Martin Amis's London Fields a bit with the climate going haywire, but you seem to have bitten off a very big subject and have it at least for the time being more or less to yourself.
I take no comfort from that. I think there will be, it's bound to encroach, because it's going to have private repercussions, not just geopolitical repercussions. When people have to move their homes or flee their countries because they're inundated by rising sea levels, this will play out on the terrain that the novel loves, which is the personal. Mm. So it is bound to. It'll come, I'm sure. And not that I want it to, but I think it's bound to come.
Having looked into this more closely than maybe not scientists, but you know, most of us humanities types, how would you handicap our chances?
Well, we're at an interesting moment in the whole debate. Public trust in the science has plummeted. Partly, I think, I mean, there were three elements. There's the disillusionments post-Copenhagen in December, the UEA emails, and the misreporting in the IPCC report of the glacier melt in the High Tibetan Plateau, out by a factor of 10, which is a serious error. The thing is that it used to be said that the human brain was the most complex object in the known universe, I mean, known to us.
Not anymore?
No, I think that if we count in the Earth's climate systems plus the biosphere in their interactions, it's probably a more complex system. Now,
that's a literary form of heliocentrism replacing geocentrism. We're not the
something has replaced us as an object of study of complexity. It is probably the most complex thing there is known to us. Climate science is very, very young. Science itself, or scientists themselves, are no different from the rest of us. They are rowdy. They can be egomaniacal. They're competitive. And I think partly the disillusion at the moment is that sections of the public thought that scientists were above all these things, that somehow their objectivity removed them from these things. But a lab or a science department in a college or university, especially when it's competing for funds with others, is as human and messy as any other institution. So a jealous or slightly catty email from one academic in UEA, Phil Jones, to another about wanting to stop the publication of a paper by a rival that was too skeptical in position. Well, the point to remember is that paper was published. Yeah. It was in the IPCC. He didn't succeed in suppressing it. He wanted to, but, you know, or, you know, so it's said. What is the other stuff in the emails? Tree ring data, a curve, a bit of missing information. You extrapolate the curve. He called it a trick. Well, it was an extrapolation.
Yeah.
A huge amount of mileage has been made by this, by not the skeptical camp, but by the denialist camp. Now, skeptics, I think skeptics are great. We need as much skepticism as possible. Science thrives on it. But the denialists are really the people, they seem to have a lot of money and a lot of influence. My challenge to the denialists is to go out and gather empirical data, send up your own satellites, go crawling across the Earth's surface and measure, put it up for peer review, and if you can demonstrate to us that the Earth is not warming, then we'll crack out the champagne. But otherwise, you must join the debate on the terms of empiricism. This is not about ideology or faith, it's simply about the facts. But the skeptics have actually done some very useful stuff. There's some very good, tough-minded people out there constantly hounding the published science. And I think that's fine. Science needs that.
I wanted to open it up to questions in a minute, and there are microphones on either side, but I reserve the right to interleave a couple of my remaining questions, too. One thing that gives me hope, of course, is that Michael Beard, maybe not solely through his own work, has cracked the problem of global warming, and so we're off the hook. When you set about devising this solution or proposed solution in the book for global warming, this way of photosynthesizing energy, I mean, I suppose you were grappling maybe later in your career than science fiction writers do with the question of coming up with something just plausible enough for readers to get past it without actually having to win the Nobel Prize in the wrong field.
Yeah.
How did you go about constructing Beard's idea?
Well, I read a lot, and I was looking for a cutting-edge technology that was still on lab benches. And then thought I could steal it, as it were, incorporate it, and go one jump ahead to an industrial, you know, a prototype in the New Mexican desert. And we're still a long way from that. But the trick, you know, if you could split water, you would have a boundless, clean form of energy, and safe, too. So, you know, there's a lab, well, the two or three here in California. There's a lab in MIT. There's one in Imperial College London, and there's a very good team in Australia. And almost certainly the Chinese are doing it too. But I didn't read anything of that. It's not easy. You know, you've got to get the materials that would be cheap. It's no good saying you could do this with and then name some rare material that you'd have to...
The new element that they haven't named yet. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, yeah. They've come up with a new transuranic element. Yeah.
Where is it on the table?
It's, I mean, toward the end. And yeah, this just broke a few days ago, and they were very superstitious about naming it.
So it's very heavy.
Oh, yes, very heavy.
Right.
But you know, it's up there with californium and berkelium and all of our nearby elements.
Right.
And
well, I'm very pleased.
Yeah. Well, imagine how we felt. But it was great because one of the scientists said, you know, this is something you never talk about.
Yeah.
You know, in the cyclotron control room, because that would be bad karma. And of course, you know, those of us, you know, given to, you know, who love words, were thinking, well, what would I call it? And the first thing I thought was bad karmium. But what would you call a new element?
I like the in Avatar. I like unobtainium.
That was good.
Yeah. It means you can't get it. Yeah.
But let's start with some questions on either side. And I can't see. Well, I guess if I pull my glasses down, I can see all right. So yeah, nobody be shy. By all means, storm the microphones. There's somebody.
Hi.
Hi.
So, I was introduced to On Chesil Beach on Radio 4, Book of Bedtime. So I got it in kind of very tiny installments, which I think was almost better than reading it in one shot. And I still think about that book, and it's been at least a couple of years since I've heard it on the radio. And that particular scene is obviously quite poignant. And I was just wondering if you had knew that scene was coming and wrote around that, or did that come as a surprise to you, as it did to me?
I have to be careful in answering this, because when you say that scene, you mean that coming scene.
that
moment of sexual failure.
No, on the beach when she...
Oh, the beach. Where they have their round.
I listened the next day because I heard the bedroom scene, and I was quite curious as to what was going to be happening next, and so that's why I turned back on.
It's a good question, actually. I always had in mind that whatever happened in this novel, they would have to end up on the beach having the conversation that would lead to the dissolution of their marriage. But what they would say and what the events were that would get them there, I could only discover by writing the book. And the other thing to say to you is, Book at Bedtime, which is a very honored BBC institution, consists of 5 or 10 15-minute readings, and the text is savagely cut.
Oh.
I mean, now, and remember, this is already a novella, and I can't listen to more than a minute of any of my own stuff. I don't mind other novelists' stuff.
But you can think, where did that sentence go? Even before, you know, it's very, very compacted and it's skillfully done. But to get a novel down to 150 minutes, which is 150 minutes of reading is probably about 10, 12,000 words. So if you liked the book at bedtime, you might like the book.
Well, yeah, I guess we should think of it as a way of inducing people to buy the book. If they did it verbatim, then people
well,
would...
Well, it didn't work in this case, so I'm a bit worried about it.
Other questions?
Or I'll jump in with some more of mine, though that's by no means
There's
to deter anybody.
Front, yeah.
Have we got one? Oh, yeah, I mean, we've got mics on either side, but as long as you're here, don't take the walk if you can project. Oh, and if since you're not at the microphone, maybe I should repeat. Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who I know is an old mate of yours, have been in the news for, but you must know it better than I do. I haven't been following the story.
Yes, they want the Pope arrested. Well, Christopher's been trying to arrest Henry Kissinger for a good while. He would have arrested Mother Teresa had she not eluded him. So he has become a sort of planetary policeman. And I don't know what going around arresting popes would achieve. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'm the proud dedicatee of God Is Not Great.
Oh.
And I have to say that I'm the one who gave Christopher his first reading lists that included, all the usual suspects, the Sam Harris and Richard and Dawkins and Dan Dennett and Steve Pinker and those types.
As a friend of Salman Rushdie, were you altogether comfortable having a book called God Is Not Great dedicated to you?
I felt deeply honored, and that's all I need to say. And it's a book I love and thought it was a superb polemic. But I think the problem for us atheists, if we're also humanists, is the extraordinary thing about religion, whether it's Catholicism or Islam or Christianity generally, is that so many people take meaning in their lives from these edifices of faith.
Yeah.
So where does that leave if you generally, as a humanist, care for and love the human project on the one hand, and yet on the other hand you feel you have no good proof that there's anyone up there, you don't think that these mindsets really advance human happiness, but a lot of other people do.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be very written into human nature, a love or reverence for the supernatural.
Was
so I'm not
your
sure
nature?
Arresting this thing, because what you're doing is resting an idea, aren't you? I'm not sure what it would achieve if one day the planet was just teeming with rational, kindly, secular humanists who got all their inspiration and awe from nature and art. That would be great, but I don't think we'll get there by any other way than simply arguing it out. And I don't think arresting anyone is going to get us there any quicker.
Well, here's a question. Who would have thought? Right here in my lap full of index cards. Do you have rules? Do you have rules for writing? Self-imposed, maddening rules?
No.
That
black ink.
Have you tried other inks and they don't work as well? Or?
No, wouldn't even try it. No, the only rule is no rules. I mean, I don't have any rules.
Or if I did, I don't know what they are at this moment.
I think we've got a question over there, have we?
Oh, yes. But I don't want to interrupt. Are you done? This is an odd question. Because before, when you were talking about the terrain of the novel sort of being the interior, when I read your work, Atonement's the book of yours that I've most recently read. And for me, I was shocked. There are all these little moments. I can't remember one in particular, but there were a lot. It wasn't like a lucky accident. There were a lot of them where it was like, not only was it a moment that I couldn't believe somebody else had recognized but me, some weird characteristic of human behavior, but then you peeled back all the layers and then you explained it perfectly in like 10 words. So my question is, do you work at that? Or is that just something that is a talent? Because I don't know how you do it. I was floored every single time I read that.
I work.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, you have to work at it. Well, here's a rule. You have to turn up at your desk. Even when you're stuck. And even when you're empty-headed. You have to turn up. If there are moments of perception that ring true in a novel like Atonement for you, that's very pleasing for me. But it only comes around by thinking of the thing itself. I'm very much an empiricist, and when I think of a moment or a difficulty or an emotion that needs to be described or some sort of human interchange that needs description, all you can do is sit very quietly and think long and hard about it. So, yes, I mean, you just have to work at it. But there's no hurry. I think that's the other point. Novels are so long. I'm sure there are plenty of people here have written novels. Even a medium-length novel of, say, 85, 90,000 words, it feels like a life's journey. And yet there's no hurry. No one will care whether you spent 3 years writing it or five. I mean, you've got to pay your rent, but from the point of view of the novel itself and your relationship with the reader, there is no hurry. So I come back to my point about hesitation. And you've got to pause before every description and say, is it true? Is it the case? And is this the most precise, concise form of putting this down? And how clear is it? I don't much go for ambiguity in writing. I like clarity. I like the writers. I like writers who celebrate the things of the world, the touch, the feel of things. Conrad, for example, or Kipling, or I think the greatest American exponent in recent time of the thinginess of life is John Updike. Beautifully sort of driven by an examining intelligence. But it all requires just careful thought. Everyone's capable of it.
Do you think you were going to be a writer no matter what?
No, I don't know. I sort of drifted into it. I did once in one of those sort of silly newspaper, what would you have done if you weren't a writer? And I said I'd be the lead guitarist, or did I say the bass guitarist, of a Grateful Dead tribute band. And that would have been a perfectly happy life.
Since you mentioned music, it's been in the news lately that you're going to write the libretto for an adaptation of...
This is Atonement. It's going to be an opera. I finished an opera last year. We put it on at the Royal Opera House, and it toured, and it's reopening in Rome later this year, and that's called For You. That was an original libretto I did with an old friend of mine, Michael Barclay, composer. But when the idea came up of doing Atonement as an opera, would I do the libretto? I thought, well, I'm already writing the screenplay of On Chisel Beach. Do I really want to recycle myself in the remaining years I have? And it's a big project to do this. You know, it's going to be a cast of thousands kind of opera. I mean, imagine that Dunkirk scene. Big male voice choirs.
Writing an original.
So the librettist is going to be the poet Craig Raine,
who's a pal of yours, right?
Yes, he's a very old friend.
Quoted, I think, in Saturday.
And yes, no, I used some of his poems because I couldn't write poetry myself. And Craig has already written librettos, so I have confidence that it's going to work out.
I had a question for you about the last story in Between the Sheets, which is an early collection of yours.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember a story called Psychopolis?
I do indeed, yeah. Every time I come to L.A., I think of it.
Well, perhaps you could probably recapitulate it a bit better than I could.
Well, it was the very first time I'd ever been in the United States. It was 1976. I was 27 years old. And I arrived in New York and I got a driveway car. Does that still happen? Where you deliver cars across the country?
You pay extra to drop it off someplace other than where you picked it up, but yeah.
No, I was delivering someone's car.
Oh, okay, yeah.
A very nasty white Toyota Celica, underpowered little white car. And I delivered it to the docks in San Francisco. But I had to do it in 7 days. And I had this extraordinary journey across the United States.
Extraordinary how?
Well, I picked up a lot of hitchhikers. And so I had many, many conversations, and I hiked a lot, leaving this car to the mercy of any car thief, I'm sure. And then I delivered another one up to Seattle, and then went up to Vancouver, met up with some friends, and we did a huge road trip going down through Idaho, Montana, down into the deserts, and ending up in L.A., where I spent 2 or 3 weeks. And when I got back to the U.K., I was so stirred by this journey and so thrilled by all the things I'd seen, and I wanted to capture some kind of freedom that I felt. So I wrote the story of a love affair about a man who, much like myself, who ends up in the story, it's quite a long story, ends up in a conversation, a drunken conversation. And at one point...
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Yeah. People are rowing about what America is and violence and guns. And at this point, the narrator has already agreed that he will give a little performance on his flute of a Bach sonata. And as he plays this sonata, he suddenly decides that everything that he always thought was valuable was beginning to peel away at the edges, and it didn't make much sense to him. And all his old European certainties of the vitality of an ancient culture were threatened. So that was really, that's where it ended, really, the story.
It's a terrific story. I was especially taken with the way, I mean, I'm a native, how Los Angeles comes across in the story. And it's not exactly an earthly paradise, is it?
No. Well, show me one. I'll go there. But,
just outside those double doors at the back. It looks as if we've got a last question. Yes?
Good evening. Thank you so much for coming to Los Angeles. When I read Enduring Love, I was just simply so in awe of your capacity to look inside the human condition and the human mind and to the human heart. And I thought of you as sort of a modern-day Shakespeare. And I just wondered, do you study psychology? That's one question. And the other question is, when you write, do you just do it at prima bozzo, like the Italians just do it, and you write it and leave it alone? Or do you go back and refine it, and do you do a lot of editing? So it's a two-part question.
I've never studied psychology formally, but I mean, all writers, all novelists are engaged in that pursuit. I often think of novels, not only novels, poetry too, as forms of exploration of consciousness and of human nature. I mean, I think that is the real investigation of what we investigate, not only as writers, but as readers. We want it unwrapped. We're such a mystery to ourselves. And it's so both amusing and tragic how we don't fully understand ourselves. And I think that's what we want from literature. Enduring Love, well, I'm glad you liked it. I think it should be clear by now that I'm not a fast writer. I go very, very slowly. And so Enduring Love, which is not a very long novel, I can tell you exactly how long it is, 87,000 words, took me 2 or 3 years doing nothing else. And I just crawled through these pages. Really. There was the one bit that wrote itself at high speed in the form that you pose as possible was the balloon scene at the beginning. I must have been halfway through the novel. I was writing this novel, but I knew I hadn't got my beginning yet.
Oh.
So I started about what is now chapter 19. And then I was hiking with an old friend somewhere in the west of Ireland, and he told me he'd seen in the newspaper a story of a ballooning accident. And when he told me about a couple of people trying to hold down a balloon and the wind coming and everyone else letting go of the ropes and one man being lifted up, I was suddenly very excited. I thought, that speaks to me of so much of the basis of our capacity for cooperating, also our selfishness and wish to survive, and the conflict of the two. And I hunted for the origin of that, but could never find it at that point anyway, but just adapted it to my own needs and wrote the beginning of the first two chapters of Enduring Love in 2 or 3 days, actually, within one real spurt, and then tidied it up later. But it must have been 4 years later, someone in a signing queue, a young German woman, said to me, I know the story. And she had the newspaper, she photocopied it, gave it to me, and it was in Bavaria. It was a Zeppelin-type balloon that was advertising a German radio station. And a man and his son were grappling with the ropes, and actually they both went up and they both fell to their deaths. And the reason that it became such a big story in Germany was someone was on the ground with a video camera, had filmed the whole accident, and Bavarian television had shown the accident on the news that night. And naturally, the close relatives of the victims of that were very upset, and it led to a huge inquiry, and I think the head of the station was sacked. But anyway, I found my source finally much later.
And did you have to go back and fiddle with the 19 chapters you'd already written, or?
Oh, yes. I mean, this was first draft, so yeah. Everything was...
How many drafts did you do?
Well, it's hard. It's very hard to tell now with word processing, because I'm redrafting all the time. Mm-hmm. But formally, I'd say, I mean, even though you're redrafting within the draft, the number of times you print it out, write all over it, type in the corrections, and then call it the next draft and start again, I would say somewhere, well, this has 6 of those. But Atonement maybe had 5. I don't know, can't remember.
There's a lovely interview with you in the New Yorker a couple of years back, conducted seemingly in the middle of your writing Solar, and you speak very candidly and interestingly about the book in progress, which I know a lot of writers are superstitious about. I take it you're still not.
Well, I've got more and more unbuttoned about this. I love reading work in progress. Yeah. I'd much rather read from work in progress than from a published book.
And use the reactions in the course of rewriting?
Yeah. I mean, it's not the same as reading alone in your study. To read to an audience, even though you don't know what people are thinking, you can't even hear them breathing, you can't see them because of the lights, it's tenser somehow and more demanding. And you feel more exposed. The prose seems more exposed. And I often make mental notes of what I want to change doing it.
Well, other than the script for On Chesil Beach, would you care to invite us into the secret of what you're up to now?
Well, that's all I'm up to at the moment. I mean, I'm between things. So I'm the long,
hesitating.
Long fallow period of hesitation has just begun. And writing a screenplay is really it's not as demanding as writing a novel. So that's how I'm occupying myself. And doing this.
Well, we look forward to whatever comes from you next. And please join me in thanking Ian McEwan for doing this.
Thank you. I forgot to say, there's one little thing, that there's going to be a signing line. Now, I've got one other appointment, and I know it's said is that I would sign copies of Solar only. I know that this is a public library event, so some people will not be able to afford Solar. I will sign a copy of Solar plus one other book, but I'm afraid I don't have time to do elaborate dedications and names and piles of backlist, because I do have friends, Los Angelinos, that I want to renew acquaintance with. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.